A Weekend with Jason Dacey replay from Money FM 89.3.
Let's review the week in international news. And for that, I'd like to welcome back Roshni Bernadette Bayasekara, journalist and professor here in Singapore. Good to see you again, Roshni.
Great to see you, Jason. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's nice that you're here to talk about another busy week in international news. And of course, we're all very saddened by the horrible shootings in Christchurch, New Zealand. The man charged over Friday's twin mosque attacks in the New Zealand city of Christchurch is believed to have acted alone, police now say. It was an Australian, I'm ashamed to say, as an Australian, Brenton Tarrant, a 28-year-old self-described white supremacist, live-streamed the attack on Facebook. What an horrific chain of events, and the fact that he showed the world via Facebook and seems very unrepentant about this whole thing.
Yes, yes, indeed, Jason. You know, it's such a tragic shooting and the worst shooting in New Zealand's history, killing, I believe now the number is up to 50. The fatalities rate went up overnight and injuring 20 people on top of that. Clearly, it was a really well-planned attack and a targeted attack against Muslims. It's important to note that Muslims make up only 1.1% of New Zealand's entire population of 4.25 million. And a large number of the victims were Muslim refugees or Muslim immigrants from war-torn countries like Afghanistan and other parts of the world like India and Indonesia. So really targeting a vulnerable community, a new community to the country. So it's really sad. My thoughts from watching the breaking news unfold over the past few days is really how social media and terrorism have merged and how social media has empowered the terrorist. You have this social media savvy terrorist of the 21st century who can really amplify his or her crimes online. And as you mentioned, the entire shooting was live streamed by a camera strapped to the shooter's body. And we've seen this before with ISIS, for instance, and many of the abductions and beheadings in the Middle East of journalists and other civilians, how really these terrorist groups use social media and excellent broadcast tools to really instill terror and document their crimes. The shooter in the New Zealand case was even able to alert his audience 10 to 20 minutes before the attack, saying, "I will be doing this."
Oh, dear.
And the images will be coming, you know, will be uploaded soon. So it's here where I wonder where cybersecurity and online monitoring have failed us or could be more vigilant in terms of just tracking these extreme right websites where such posts are coming up on.
You know, it's been interesting, isn't it, seeing some of the reaction we've had from some of the world leaders. You know, right here in Singapore, we had Minister for Law and Home Affairs, K. Shanmugam, saying that it's a very fine line between hate speech and free speech.
Exactly. And I think this sad shooting raises the broader and critical issue of what media policies are in relation to terrorist propaganda and videos. And when do you have the right to suspend an online account? When do you have the right to issue takedown orders? How the laws can be enhanced to curb such situations? Because from the recent press that I've read, the video is still completely viral and it's still being uploaded on YouTube and Twitter and Facebook and Reddit. And it highlights, sadly, how these social media platforms try and fail repeatedly to address these far-right extremist groups and their platforms.
And it is alarming, isn't it, when we see the number of these white supremacist incidents that have sprung up all over the world. You know, in the last probably, 6 to 8 years, it seems to be getting worse and worse.
Exactly. And, you know, when the posting starts to gain momentum online, you have the other groups chiming in and it becomes sort of a global rally to encourage such violent attacks. And so it just gains tremendous momentum via the social media platforms.
Yeah. All right, let's change to another story over the last few days. It was this was in Australia, in my homeland. George Pell sentenced, of course, he was a very prominent Catholic church priest who was sentenced to prison And it was actually broadcast in Australia, wasn't it, his sentencing? And this is the highest figure in the Vatican that's been sentenced and convicted, right?
Exactly. Very sad and shocking story in many regards. And as you said, the most senior Catholic figure to be convicted, I believe, with 6 years as the sentence stands. But where we're at right now is that he's been quite forthright that he wants to go for an appeal. And this is headed to an appeals court. And he maintains his innocence. His conviction, as you said, really rocked the Catholic Church to its core.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was one of the Pope's closest advisors for quite some time. I believe the appeal is coming up in June for his case.
Well, he's in his late 70s, isn't he? So I guess they're trying to argue that it's, you know, inhumane to send someone to prison at this age. But when you look at the allegations, Roshni, they are alarming, aren't they?
Yes. And, you know, on the foundation for his appeals case, over and above the health concerns and that he's elderly,
yeah.
I think the main stumbling block from a legal perspective is that the crux of the case was based on one victim and the testimony from one victim, because the other victim apparently died of a drug overdose.
Correct, yes.
And so legally, that is how the appeal will probably go, saying that it wasn't substantiated enough or there should have been more witnesses to his crimes or his alleged crimes. And, you know, apparently each of the five charges he faced carried a maximum 10-year jail term.
Mm.
So some would argue that he got off on 6 years,
which
was pretty lenient in some perspectives.
Mm. Yeah, it's really alarmed a lot of people. We're doing our International News Week in Review with Roshni Bernadette, a Biasikara journalist and professor. Now, you had a busy week last week because you were involved with the Franco-Singaporean Econ Conference at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy.
That's right, yes.
Tell me a bit about that. It sounds interesting. Some really big names were attending.
Exactly. It was a power-packed lineup. We had the Minister Heng Swee Keat, who attended the closing ceremony, Minister Chan Chung Seng, who oversees trade and industry, the former French Minister of Finance and the Economy, Michel Sapin, French Ambassador to Singapore, Marc Abanceau, and the dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School, Kishore Mahbubani, as well as climate change experts from the National Climate Change Secretariat, which comes under the Prime Minister's office. Bernard Cha was representing in that capacity. So really a very impressive lineup of thinkers and visionaries discussing how we are facing new horizons on the world economy and honing in on some key areas of discussion, such as innovation, climate change, digitization of our economies, leadership, globalization and integration, as well as reinforcing the long-standing partnership and strong bilateral relations between Singapore and France.
It's funny you should say that. I got a lot of French friends here in Singapore, and I noticed that there are a lot of French people in Singapore compared to when I first arrived here maybe, you know, almost 20 years ago. There's been a lot of French companies here, and you talk about the relations with across different cultural and business lines.
Exactly, and there is a French school here,
yes.
and a tremendous amount of economic and manufacturing and industrial commitment. But really, what's an interesting factoid, over and above the educational and the economic ties between the two countries and the cultural, the roots of the Singaporean and French connection are actually religious.
Is that right?
That's right, because a committee of priests came to Singapore some time ago, and they established themselves in the Catholic Church in Singapore and in the Catholic schools, the Catholic High School, which is actually the school that the Prime Minister of Singapore graduated from.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Wow. So those ties go back a long way. What was the biggest takeaway that you got out of this conference last week?
Now, the big news from the forum was the opening of a new committee or hub, should I say, that will be spearheaded by the French Ministry of Higher Education, Research and Innovation, and Singapore's National Research Foundation. So effectively, this is going to be the setting up of a Franco-Singaporean innovation hub, with the thinking being that innovation can really transform tomorrow's economy and society. As an example of some of the technology and the innovation that the two countries are working on, the French ambassador, Marc Abanceau, cited a new innovative technology that allows the lifts in HDB blocks to detect issues with elderly persons who are in the lifts. Mm-hmm. So if they fall, if they have an accident, if there's some form of frailty, yeah. this new surveillance mechanism in a lift can help the elderly. So really very relevant technology and innovative measures to help an aging population in Singapore, as the population is aging in France as well. And other key issues discussed, globalization and inequality, and the changing interaction between Asia and Europe as the dynamics in the United States change.
Mm. And opportunities for ASEAN, isn't it? Yes. And Singapore particular.
Yes, exactly. And as Dean Mabubani put it, as one of the eminent thinkers and intellectuals on the panel, he made a very important comment that the changing nature of governments will continue as administrations change in the West, but that effectively people and relationships on several policy issues remain strong and committed to those issues, such as climate, for instance.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, the great idea. I live in a HDB aging estate in the East Coast, and with a lot of old people, and I know that would help with a, you know, could be helped by this technology. So let's go on now with our International News Week in Review with Roshni Bernadette Abaya Sakara, journalist and professor. We heard about it in the news, the stars of the 1994 British film Four Weddings and a Funeral, so popular here in Singapore, reuniting for the first time in 25 years in the name of Comic Relief Charity and helping raise £63 million. How about that?
That is pretty impressive. You know, I was looking through some articles on the movie, and I remember it back in 1994. Mm. It only cost $5 million to make it at the time, and they made $52 million at the box office.
Wow.
And now they're topping it with the number you just gave us.
Yeah, and we saw Hugh Grant and, of course, Andy McDowell. Hugh Grant now is in his late 50s, and their kid is getting married in part of this reunion. It's only a small kind of mini sequel, right? It's not the whole thing, but isn't it amazing to think that Hugh Grant's pushing 60?
Well, you could never tell. He's got a full head of hair and a flat tummy. He doesn't look 60 to me.
Yeah, he's quite still a hunk, right? I think now the older you get, you can still pull it off if you're a George Clooney or a, you know, Hugh Grant or whoever else. Harrison Ford's probably in his late 70s now, right? Well into his 70s.
I think it's the laps in the pool. I think they do a lot of laps in the pool.
The key is to stay trim, lean and mean, right? And just doesn't matter. And keep your hair, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. It's been a pleasure once again. I'd like to thank Roshni Bernadette Abaya Sakara, journalist and professor. This has been our International News Week in Review. Thank you, Roshni.
Thank you.